Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, sound systems and counterculture. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here as usual with my friend Tim Lawrence. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Tim is going to introduce this week's special guest, who we're very excited to talk to.
Yes. So Jem and I are meeting today with Emily Lordy. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
Hi, Emily. So, yeah, just to introduce Emily, Emily's a writer, professor and cultural critic whose focus is African-American literature and Black popular music. She's a professor based professor of English, based at Vanderbilt University, and has written three books, Black Resonance, Iconic Women Singers and African-American Literature, which was published by Rutgers in 2013, Donny Hathaway Live, which was part of the Bloomsbury 33 and a Third series, which is always fantastic. That was published in 2016. And most recently, The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s, which was published by Duke in 2020. And Emily also writes for NewYorker.com, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Style Magazine, and many other publications and broadcasters. So we're really happy that you can join us today, Emily. Your work is very broad-ranging and at the same time really nestles into what we've really been very interested in so far, which is this period of the, you know, the early 70s in particular, but and how that kind of in some ways grew out of the late 1960s. And has, you know, often, although not always, a focus on kind of, you know, African-American music and the way that that kind of has kind of rippled throughout, you know, the United States and even globally, and has also absorbed global influences in its own aesthetic. So really, really happy you can join us and shed some insight, further insight, we hope, into the phenomenon, the history, the music that is organized around soul. Before we get into all of that, I'd be really interested if you could just tell us a little bit about your own background, how you got into writing about Black music, how you got into soul, how you went from living in the Northeast to Nashville.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you. And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me. So I grew up in the Northeast. I grew up one of those kids who loved performing and did so every chance I could get, whether in the church choir or in the jazz band or in the rock group or indeed in dance class, which is where I spent a lot of my time outside of school. So I grew up with a great appreciation for and love of the performing arts, particularly music and dance. But, you know, I was really more equipped, I think, to be a writer. You know, at the end of the day, I was pretty good as a singer and I was pretty good as a dancer. But, you know, I reached my 20s and realized that the sheer physical labor that was going to be required and also, frankly, economic precarity that was going to be required to pursue either of those vocations was perhaps beyond what I was capable of. And I mentioned that in part because I think my work as a writer and a critic and a scholar is really informed by that turn, so to speak, away from the actual labor of performing and the risk that it requires, in that I really, I think, appreciate what artists do, those who have been able to, you know, by dint of resilience, determination, a great deal of talent, luck, context, etc., those who have been able to make a life in the arts. I think I really appreciate more what it takes because I didn't. but what I did do was enter graduate school in 2001, where I was at Columbia University in New York, and I studied African-American literature and music under the mentorship of Robert O'Mealy, who was the founder of something called the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia, and was a real pioneer in these sort of interdisciplinary conversations that were bringing together African-American music and literature, visual art in myriad forms. So that was sort of my entree into the world of Black music and literature.
What department were you in then? Sorry.
Yeah, I was in the English department, the Department of English and Comparative Literature, yes, the home of Spivak and Said. And
Yeah. I was there for a couple of years myself, but that's, but 7 years before you, so.
Oh, okay. Yes. I didn't know that.
Well, I sometimes forget myself, so.
Yeah, it was a good place to be,
Yeah, it was a good place to be, yeah, in many ways. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted you anyway. I was just wondering if you were in music or indeed in literature, but yeah, you were in literature.
Right, of course. So my primary academic training is really as a literary critic. It is not as a musicologist, but because I knew enough as a performer and as, again, somebody who is just a general devotee of popular music, I could write about music, I think, in a way that was not technical necessarily, but accurately descriptive of what I was hearing, and in a way that resonated with other lay people, right? Other, you know, fellow listeners and fans. And so, but I used nonetheless the skills of close reading, you know, that I honed as a literary critic to read not only the lyrics, but also the performative choices that the singers and other musicians that I was studying were making. So I was in English, and there was a lot of work, especially a lot of energy at that time around the connections between literature and blues music, literature and jazz music, but not so much soul music. Soul was often kind of left out of that conversation for reasons that I might get into later. But I did find, for instance, that there wasn't as much scholarly attention to somebody like Aretha Franklin at that time, again, early 2000s, as there was to a Bessie Smith or a Billie Holiday or any number of, you know, artists in other genres. Not that there was much critical attention to those Black women artists either, but there was more, I found, you know, than had been done on somebody like an Aretha or a Nina Simone or a Gladys Knight, you know, and I wrote about women in different genres for my dissertation, which became my first book, Black Resonance. But I did move increasingly toward soul. My first book ends with a study, a sort of interdisciplinary study of the work of Nikki Giovanni, the Black arts poet Nikki Giovanni, and Aretha Franklin, who Nikki Giovanni wrote about and knew. And my work since then has sort of taken off from that concluding chapter, and that I've really been focused more on the late 60s, early 70s soul movement.
You would say there's much more likely to be sort of, you know, something, you know, an analysis of Bessie Smith rather than Aretha. Why do you think that was? Because Aretha's a well-known figure, a dynamic figure, a kind of global, internationally famous figure. Do you think there was a sort of a higher valuing of blues and jazz versus soul? Was soul somehow denigrated or not taken seriously?
I think that there was a greater academic legitimation of both blues and jazz. There were interdisciplinary studies that were thinking about something called blues literature, jazz literature. And these were largely indebted to the person who was a key cultural figure at the time, which was Ralph Ellison. So a lot of interdisciplinary Black studies work, at least particularly in under the rubric of English, was centered around Ralph Ellison, who, as we know, not only wrote Invisible Man, but wrote several important essays on jazz and American culture, as well as the blues. So I think in part because of Ellison's prominence, I mean, it's hard not to love Ellison in a way. I mean, he's a very sharp critic of American politics and student of American music. But he was a liberal. He was somebody who was interested in talking about the elevation of Black vernacular culture to the status of a high art. And you know, he was interested in the sort of democratic process. But he was really interested in Americanness and improving the Americanness of Black subjects and of Black artists. And that appealed to a certain kind of a mainstream liberal sensibility that I think was preeminent in certain sectors of the academy at the time that I was studying, and ended up sort of privileging some older, more traditional forms such as jazz and blues more than the avant-garde and the radical experimental work that we got, you know, at a kind of post-Ellison moment later on in moving into the 60s with experimental jazz as well as soul and funk. And so I think it, the reason is twofold. It's partly that there was a kind of more politically moderate view of what was important within Black culture at that particular moment. The other problem, I should say, with soul music, so to speak, was that it was so popular. And there was a kind of general suspicion, I think, of the sheer commercial success of an Aretha Franklin in the 60s as, you know, as later.
It'd be interesting also to hear you also hear your thoughts on like the existing work, you know, pre your own book. I mean, obviously there have been several kind of important books about soul music, which you wanted to, which you either wanted to take issue with or develop the analysis of. So I was wondering if you could sort of reflect on kind of why you thought it was important to write more about soul. I mean, so you've sort of touched on this partly, I think, in your kind of reference to kind of some of the ideas of collectivity. It's a really interesting argument. But yeah, just interested to hear what you make of some of the, what you thought about existing literature on soul music and what you thought it was, you know, maybe getting right, but also what it was quite not, foregrounding in a way that you led you to want to write this book, The Meaning of Soul.
Yeah, sure. So there were some really outstanding studies of soul. For instance, Brian Ward's Just My Soul Responding, which I believe is from the late 90s. And there were also some good studies that were just emerging of individual artists who would be considered soul artists. There was a really important essay to me published in the journal Callaloo by Daphne Brooks, and it was called Nina Simone's Triple Play, and it was about Nina Simone's innovations, you know, within Black music. And Mark Anthony Neal had done some really good work also theorizing soul and its commercial meanings and its cultural resonances, you know, within his books. Well, I guess, first of all, I should also say that there was a lot of critical energy when I started writing that book, which was around 2013, around the concept of post-soul. And post-soul was sort of like a critical shorthand for a post-civil rights movement, Black cultural production, everything from, you know, the Boondocks TV show to Outkast's, you know, music. And it was thinking about the new possibilities that were opened up in this irreverent, kind of multifaceted, perhaps more queer, heterogeneous, feminist space of Black culture that had supposedly been suppressed by the masculinist, unitary impulses of the Black arts, Black power movements, right? So post-soul, everything, you know, gets free and funky and we can say whatever we want and do whatever we want and everybody's included. And first of all, I don't think that's true or an accurate assessment of, you know, what happens after civil rights. But more importantly, the image that it ended up painting of this thing called soul, which it generally didn't define, except in opposition to post-soul, was of a very restrictive, heteronormative and narrow kind of space. So it was largely in protest against that vision of soul, the vision of soul being peddled by post-soul theory, that I wanted to write this recuperative study of soul. But it was also because even those studies of soul that I thought were really quite valuable didn't tend to foreground women, as in the case of Brian Ward's excellent study, and weren't as comprehensive as I thought they could be. In the case of, you know, even Mark Anthony Neal or Anina, you know, the Nina Simone essay by Daphne Brooks that I mentioned, where it was about individual figures, but not thinking about them in terms of this, you know, what soul itself actually was. So, you know, my ambition was really to do for soul what some other scholars had done for jazz and the blues, and to think about, you know, its actual meanings and its resonances beyond music, and also to offer a feminist vision of this genre. And finally, to think about, you know, what it did for people on an everyday level. We think about soul often as a protest music, which sure it was, but more interesting to me was the really intimate ways in which it allowed Black people to speak to each other, to keep each other going, which is a legacy of the church, right? That legacy of encouragement that we get from so many Black worship traditions. And again, like those sort of everyday encounters that didn't necessarily privilege the white power structure and didn't always see soul through that lens of, you know, needing to speak back to power or resist, right? Sometimes it was about relating. It was about that collectivity that you make together, you know, when nobody's watching and when maybe for a moment you're forgetting that there's a, you know, what James Baldwin calls the terror that stretches outside, you know, outside your door. So
I think that you say in the book that you wanted to also like explore a realm of soul that didn't sort of necessarily see it as a kind of vehicle for civil rights messaging, that politically it was about, you know, an upward mobility or a form of assimilationism, and that it was kind of, and that it often in scholarship, or at least in the way that I would teach it, but many of us would in shorthand, is to kind of say, yeah, Motown and civil rights and Martin Luther King, and attempt to kind of, you know, be treated as equals. So I just wondered if you could speak, you know, expand on that somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when people think about soul in politics, one of the first tracks they might think of would be Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, which was an important song for civil rights. They might think of Mississippi Goddamn by Nina Simone, which is another, you know, really important song of the movement, and a song of rage in many ways, inspired by the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. They might think of a song like James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, which is a more valedictory statement of Black pride and unity and power. And, you know, those are all, indeed in a slightly different register, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. And there are many other examples. But I think that while that political energy certainly was there, when people focus on that and privilege that, there's a lot that gets left out of the conversation. One thing that gets left out is all the songs that are about love, right? The songs of Aretha's Dr. Feelgood. And what a revolutionary message of Black female erotic desire that is, right? In its own right, even though it's not, you know, protesting the latest, you know, violence against Black people, or calling for the kind of Black pride that James Brown was calling for. But that sort of a song would get left out of a vision of politicized soul that focused narrowly on civil rights, Black power politics, as would a focus on the music itself. So when we think about, you know, if we locate the value of soul in its political messaging, then we're really just thinking about the lyrics of these songs mainly, right? Or we're privileging the lyrics as the vehicle for that message. But there's so much richness in the music, in the musicality, you know. I mean, even the soundscapes that are created by the ensemble of artists working on Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, there's so much to say about how complicated they are and how they might in fact work in tension with any sort of straightforward message we might glean from that particular record. The way that Aretha Franklin sings, you know, the choices that these artists are making, there's just so much more to say about the music than what it says. And so that was something else that I wanted to do, is when we, again, deprioritize the so-called political message on the surface, we can think about a lot more of the interesting, radical, revolutionary things these artists are doing, both in lyrics and in other modes.
I mean, for me, the important point about most of that music, I mean, the crucial point for understanding its politics in a historical context, is the way in which that sonically it gives voice to a certain kind of utopianism that it draws from gospel, but also sort of secularizes. I think your sort of close readings of a lot of these tracks are really helpful in drawing out some of those aspects. But I want to come back to post-soul, because I think listeners are going to be really interested in that, and it's a really important notion. But I wondered if you could say something before that, just about the what's one of the initial pieces of analysis that you do in the book, which is the shift in the meaning of soul, the shift from an explicitly spiritual understanding of soul, which is arguably they're like in Du Bois's Souls of Black Folks, to a kind of secularized notion of soul. So referring to a dimension of social experience, which is secular in nature by the, you know, say by the end of the 60s. Can you say a little bit about that? Because it's a very interesting analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And that was so important to the book to think about that shift in meaning, where soul, as many people know, it is a spiritual term, and soul music itself begins in the church. The crucible of its primary modes really is Black worship and Black Baptist worship in particular. So, and I think Brian Ward himself identifies some of these strategies for, you know, music making within that space. For instance, the building, the layering, and the kind of no holds barred performative expression. So these things, you know, are born in the church, and they do make their way into soul music, in part because so many artists who begin in the church cross over into this more secular pop realm, what is initially known as R&B, and then becomes known later as soul. But I think that, you know, this idea that the last shall be first, that we shall overcome, all of these, you know, very old religious ideas are helpfully transmuted into not only soul music, but also the discourse surrounding soul, by which I mean this question that's circulating in the late 60s, especially, is what is soul? Like, who gets to have it? What does it actually mean? And what people come back to again and again in these conversations, Black cultural critics in particular, is that it has to do with having been through something. It has to do with struggle, personal struggle, social struggle, and with this sense that, you know, we've been there before and we will get through it again. We got through it then, and we'll be able to sort of draw on these resources, these inner resources, and just the sheer fact of experience in order to survive the next trial. That's a very churchy idea, but it was particularly useful, I think, in this political moment that was so charged and so violent and so exciting at the same time. There was a radical promise there of, you know, this ability to overcome, that soul music, I think, really helped people give voice to.
Yeah, the term you use a few times in the book and in the title, I think, as well, as resilience, which I think is a really interesting term in that context. I mean, really, what you're talking about in that particular historical moment is an experience of political struggle, which involves some successes and also significant defeats. And it seems like you're talking about a sort of affective disposition which enables people, which makes it possible to survive those defeats. Is that right?
I think that would be a good way to put it. Yes, an affective disposition, again, that is, you know, certainly not natural. There's nothing innate about it, but
no, it's sort of cultivated.
Exactly, it's cultivated through time, through community, through discourse, through music, and that one needs to sort of keep recultivating,
yeah, right?
And that again is where the music comes in, and where sermons come in. And I think, you know, what I'll finally say is that if I have any reservations about the book, or if there's anything I would do differently, is that I do draw too clear of a line, I think, between the spiritual or the religious experience of soul and the secularization of soul. I think that there's people are still going to church, right? To put it very bluntly, and there's still so much, you know, religiosity. The fact that Aretha Franklin, yes, crosses over, but then crosses back into the church and performs Amazing Grace in 1971 is a good example of the fact that people don't really leave the church, in other words. And that doesn't just mean they take the church with them. It means they literally go back, and they need to refill, you know, at that particular well, I think, time and time again. And I'm thinking about that more with Whitney Houston, who was actually the same way, that she needed to sort of return to the church. And so that's just a long way of saying that I think that that spiritual gospel element that gives birth to soul is not something that soul then takes leave of, that there's a continued engagement with the church and gospel throughout.
Yeah, that seems really important. I mean, to me, as one reason I think that's such a useful analysis is it speaks to the question that I'm always I'm always preoccupied with, and I'm always trying to get students to think about, which is the question of, well, why does African-American music take on this global importance? Like, why does it have this broad appeal? We're working on an episode about Northern Soul, which is this phenomenon of people in the north of England, the industrial north of England in the 70s, becoming really sort of obsessed with soul music of the 1960s. And it's partly, and partly it's because it seems to give people something that they need at that moment. They need this, they need the capacity to cultivate this affective disposition, which can, you know, which comes out of an experience of solidarity and can enable people to endure to some extent. So it's a really, really useful analysis.
Love is the Message, a podcast about music, counterculture, parties and politics with Tim Lawrence and Jeremy Gilbert.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's partly reflecting on what you were saying about Ralph Ellison and partly coming out of what you're saying about the, you know, the contribution of the church as a form of collectivity and the way that soul picks us up without ever divorcing it, itself from it. Yeah, I just was wondering if you can think, just to explore more about how, in a way, you argue, which is an argument that I particularly love in the book, that soul sort of opposes the you know, the practice, the idea, the ideology of liberal subjecthood. You also go on to sort of say, and also neoliberal individualism, that comes a little bit later, but they're connected, of course. But that what it does is it articulates this resilience that's kind of collective. And at one point, you sort of say that you say it's about staying with the band, which is just a phrase I love. And there are so many examples that we sort of do know about, and that, you know, I think we've sort of been aware of that, you know, as this kind of symbolic marker, if you like, that, you know, in the 60s there are Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers and Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions and Eddie Kendricks and David Ruffin from the Temptations and Diana Ross and the Supremes and the Jackson 5 that then becomes Michael Jackson, and so there are all these groups, these collectivities that then break up in the late 60s or the early 1970s, and somehow this becomes in itself a sort of symbol of the collectivity of soul beginning to break up. And, you know, these individuals, I mean, Michael Jackson is kind of is obviously this really key figure here, how, you know, then becoming kind of this global pop superstar, the best known global pop superstar out of this soul matrix, this soul practice, and becomes I don't know if I should say like a victim of, like, you know, the neoliberal conjuncture, but, you know, he ends up earning more money than any, you know, musical artist before him, and he spends more money than any musical artist before him, and he dies in the middle of trying to pay back his debt, pretty much, you know. So without, that's maybe getting a bit morbid for this, but I'm very interested in going back to you know a deep, you know, just to hearing you speak about this, the collective articulation. I mean just touching on, sorry, I'm saying too much here, but for us it's the church, but it's also the dance floor. It's this kind of collective joy that you can get out of soul music that basically, we might come back to disco in a bit as well, but it's that aspect of soul that disco completely embraces.
Right, exactly. And so I guess I could start with, as you have mentioned, the collective worship traditions that soul grows out of, that, you know, it's congregational at base. The church traditions that give rise to the practices, the techniques of soul, and indeed the rhetoric and the ideology, as I was suggesting, of soul, that sense of overcoming and you know, fundamental resilience, group resilience. But there's an interesting way that intersects in the 60s with the discourse of the Black aesthetic, where people are saying, Black artists such as Leroy Jones, who becomes Amiri Baraka, who I should say becomes a central figure in Black studies, like just sort of edging out Ellison, I think, like in the 2000s, like Black studies moment that I was describing, where Ellison is a preeminent figure. And I would venture to say that it's more somebody like Baraka now, who's a more ostensibly radical and experimentally, you know, kind of wild artistic figure. Anyway, but people like Baraka in the 60s are are saying, you know, we are developing our own thing. We're developing our own basis of judging the value of Black art. And so the gatekeepers who, you know, the white establishment that has historically been invested in determining whether or not our art was valuable is no longer of importance to us, and we will decide. And what that means is it's a fundamental shift of deciding that Black people, the so-called community, will be the arbiters of the value of Black art. It's a shift toward that communal understanding that the music isn't good if Black people aren't dancing to it, right? It's not good if it's not moving the crowd. And that, again, it's rooted in gospel, that if you can't make people feel what you're saying, if you can't make them, you know, get up and feel the spirit, then you really haven't done anything. It doesn't matter how good you sang, right? But that idea is politicized and collectivized in a certain way in the Black arts era. And so we get the idea not only of music for the people, but poetry for the people, and, you know, people rapping and performing their poetry on the street. We get, you know, ideas about the people's theater and these grassroots organizations that are growing up and are just really valuing, you know, the idea of speaking to and for a Black audience. And so, you know, to relate that to soul specifically, there's a scholar named Jason King who talks about soul as this concept of getting togetherness. And I think it's in an article on Roberta Flack, actually. Soul is getting togetherness, getting yourself together, I would say, first and foremost, but then getting together, you know, with this collective to make something happen, even if it's that, even if it's just, you know, to get people to dance. Gladys Knight, you know, shifting gears a little bit, just, you know, toward her professional trajectory, you know, she's another kind of product of the church. She and her brothers and her cousins, who become Gladys Knight and the Pips, you know, form a group that forms in Atlanta. They're old school in a way. They're about the family unit, right? A little bit before the Sly Stone's family affair. But, you know, they're very invested in some sort of traditional ideas about keeping it in the family success, Black excellence also. And I think on some level, Gladys Knight just realized she was more excellent with the Pips than she was going to be on her own, right? Maybe she would have been more commercially viable, you know, taking the route that Marvin Gaye had taken, that Diana Ross had taken, but it wasn't going to be the same spirit. And so I love them. In part, they're just not considered as much in studies of soul as some of these other artists and groups. But I also love, you know, not only their decision to stay together, but also the fact that it was explicitly political, that one of the members of the group said, we are trying to give Black organization, we're trying to give Black children and older Black people a model of an organization that stays together for the long durée, right? That doesn't splinter off into factions, as we're going to see these other groups doing, but that really kind of sticks it out together. And he, you know, he did mean that to be a kind of a political model that would do a certain kind of work in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, it's just this idea that you know, I think the quote in the book sort of says, you know, people have been trying to steal me for years. This is a Gladys Knight quote, but we are all one, a unit. And it's that, you know, enables them to, you know, survive to the, and keep going to the point where they do receive some fame. But it also, it embodies a kind of a set of values that gives them a sense of, you know, I mean, this was my understanding of what you're writing, which is pretty clear. I think it gives them a sort of a resourcefulness for life. Which we can value to, you know, anyone can value at any point, at any time, really. I don't know if it's unfashionable now or not. Maybe it's newly fashionable, but yeah, it's kind of just not trying to seek out kind of a form of individual expression as the ultimate form of expression and destiny within, you know, American society or Western society.
That's right. I would think I would also just add, and I think that you see that in a way, you know, to think about what happens in the postal era, in the idea of the crew, right? That the soul band becomes, one might argue, the hip hop crew, or just, you know, those people that you see, they're not part of the band necessarily, or maybe they are, you know, they have it perhaps in its original form, they actually do have different roles. You know, they have the DJ, we have the MC, we have these different, you know, people who are, we have the dancers. But, you know, now if you look at the coterie or the entourage, you know, of a person like Drake, right, who travels around with people who might not have any artistic contribution to the brand, but are nonetheless crucial resources for him. These people are necessary, right? They're the people that he can unwind with at the end of the day, that that allow him to just, in terms of a professional career, to keep going. And so we could see the sort of morphing or the transmutation of the band into this concept of the sort of touring crew. But what I wanted to say about the band is that I think it's also important to not be, for me, to not express a kind of romanticism of the collective, that it's hard to stay with the band. This is one reason why bands always break up, is that like there's competing interests. There's just so different, you know, life paths. And Gladys Knight at some point did leave the group to have children. And there's different things people want to do. A lot of times, you know, you're just tired. You want to, you know, settle down, have a family. And there's all kinds of reasons, very good reasons why the band might break up, just as there are a lot of pressures, you know, that that artists face in an era like the 60s to speak to the people, you know, to not quote unquote sell out, to not become too big. Arguably, that's one reason why Aretha goes back to the church, is not just for her own personal edification, but because people are otherwise accusing her of having strayed too far, you know, and she has to prove, she has to sort of re-authenticate herself and her investment in the people. I don't think that's necessarily what was happening, but I'm just saying that that there are certain things that artists need to do because there's a pressure in an era like that, particularly for minoritized artists, to stay with the group, right? And just keep speaking with and valuing that connection. And I just don't want to be romantic about that, because I think that, that that's very hard for some people.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess there's also, you know, it's true that you can't always express what you want to do within the collective, that there can be constraints. And that was, you know, maybe one of the reasons why, you know, so many of these solo artists emerged out of these lineups. And there's clearly some sort of, you know, there can be some expressive gains that come out of that. But when you leave the collective, you also, you can lose something. I mean, you can leave one collective and move to another, right? Or there's just such an unrelenting emphasis now on sort of, you know, the individual artist and expression, that you feel as though just somehow or other, a lot of the music that was being made in the 60s and the 70s, people were just having a better time making it. And it was because it was often a more collective experience. And I think that, although, yes, I agree, you can't romanticize that. But there is something to value. I was wondering if, like, we spoke a bit about Gladys Knight and the Pips. Could you? I'd really love to hear you also speak a bit more about Minnie Riperton or Rotary Connection, because Minnie's on. You know, she, again, she's one. Well, I mean, I think we both really value the way that you know draw attention to some of the, you know, not always celebrated soul artists, in particular female artists, and Minnie Riperton, of course, is one of them. And she's on your cover, not the most predictable figure to put on the cover of a book.
Right.
So that's wonderful. I'd love to hear more about that choice. I just, you know, I can't get enough of Rotary Connection these days, so I'd love to hear you talk about Rotary Connection. So that's my intro to my prompt to hear more about Minnie Riperton and Rotary Connection and how they figure in this kind of this soul matrix.
I'd love to talk more about Minnie Riperton. And you're right that she's a very unlikely figure to adorn a book called The Meaning of Soul, because she isn't often considered to be a soul singer. And a lot of people don't even know who she is. But yes, she started out, you know, born and raised in Chicago, and started out with a group called Rotary Connection, which is, to the point about psychedelic soul, kind of one of these early psychedelic soul bands informed by rock and blues. And Charles Stepney was their producer and arranger. So a lot of classical, Western classical influences as well. It was extraordinary, mostly a cover band, but just extraordinary recreations of some of the great, they do a great version, for instance, of Aretha Franklin's Respect.
Don't you know I got it? All I'm
as well as a lot of other, they do a song by Cream, and you know, Eric Clapton's Cream, and different groups. So they were all over the map, but I loved including them in part because they represented the kind of melange of soul. You know, I talked earlier about wanting to break soul out of the straitjacket that it had been put in by studies of post-soul, and to show that it was a really heterogeneous, vibrant, feminist, and even potentially queer space. I should say, Gail Wald does a lot of that work in her study of the television show Soul, produced by Ellis Hazlip. And I was vastly inspired by the work that she did in that book, which came out just before mine, to think about soul in this more capacious way. But in any case, so Rotary Connection, which is a group of, you know, fronted by Minnie Riperton, but also has Black and white men in the band, and is very kind of musically multifaceted, was a great, although short-lived and not commercially viable soul group, the late 60s. And Minnie Riperton sort of went off on her own shortly thereafter and forged a solo career. Loving You was her biggest hit single. She worked with Stevie Wonder and some other people. And she developed what the scholar Farrah Jasmine Griffin calls a kind of bohemian soul. You know, she was a Black flower child. She was a little bit like a softer Sly Stone, actually, in that way, you know, sort of connected to, she eventually, you know, moved to the West Coast and sort of connected to that more sort of West Coast bohemian laid back aesthetic, that lifestyle. She married a white man, Richard Rudolph, I think his name. And one of their children is the comedian Maya Rudolph, actually. But anyways, that's all to say that she was an outlier in many ways, making her own way. I mean, one reason why it was hard for her to get a recording contract is because she had this very pure soprano sound and a name that wasn't markedly Black. So people would hear her oftentimes and assume she was a white artist, and she would show up and they would essentially close the door on her because she just didn't fit people's narrow conception of what a Black woman singer would be. She didn't sing blues. She wasn't, you know, that sort of gritty gospel-fired powerhouse. I mean, she could actually belt like that, but she often chose not to. It was a softer, quieter, more introspective aesthetic. And I think it was important to bring that into soul, not only to show that soul was, you know, quite internally varied, but also to show that there was this sense of introspection within it and the sense of internal possibility that was just as important. And one might argue a vehicle for the sense of collective possibility that soul was inspiring and promoting.
Even now, 20 years after, right, almost 20 years after Love Saves the Day came out, is sort of more and more compelled by the way that disco is really rooted, you know, in many different sounds or grows out of many different sounds, kind of coming together on these dance floors of the early 70s, but really seems to kind of be a continuation of soul music. And reading your book kind of, in a sense, confirms that. It's expressing, you know, the importance of collectivity, and it's connecting it to, of course, the, you know, the church, and it's about you know, reverting to these kind of forms, these modes of collectivity to overcome hardship, repression, and to, you know, what disco really did explicitly, which you don't hear, you know, quite so obviously in, let's say, some funk, is you move to this point of collective joy. Which is what gospel obviously kind of brings to R&B in many ways. And disco just embraces, and it kind of repackages it a bit. It gives it a bit of, let's say, very simplistically, a four on the floor bass beat. It becomes prominent. But a lot of these pre-disco classics like Eddie Kendrick's Girl, You Need a Change of Mind. Indeed, something like Rotary Connection, Black Gold of the Sun, is the kind of captures some of these kind of, you know, this kind of ecstatic joy, the building to these crescendos. So I just wondered how, you know, as someone who's written this, you know, important book on soul music, just how you might see, you know, the phenomenon of disco, whether it does go on to, you know, go. I mean, there's also, I mean, sorry, the other thing is like the prominent, the absolute clear prominence of Black women within disco, as being these figures who, you know, who come to process effectively hardship and, you know, pain and, you know, and let it all out through their voice and through music as a kind of, you know, almost a collective therapeutic process. So these, you know, the Black female diva becomes this iconic figure in disco. So yeah, before we get onto post-soul, how much you might see disco as being kind of a continuation of soul, or maybe you see it as a corruption of soul or abandonment of soul or a commercialization of soul, or maybe none of the above.
That's an interesting question, and it's a oversight in the book, really, to not say more about disco. I mean, I understand in some ways what is happening when a scholar like Nelson George sort of writes it off as a corruption, a corruptive force or corrosive force within Black music. And I think that that there is a real anxiety about not only commercialization and the so-called like dilution of Black music, but also about queerness that is certainly never speaks its name, but I think that is very much at the root of some people's anxiety about what happens to Black music in the disco era. You know, that having been said, I don't sort of draw the line through disco. And I think that might be in part because the collective space there is the club where soul sort of begins. If the collective space that soul begins in is the church, you know, the space that it would go to, move to, in its permutations into disco would certainly be obviously the dance floor of the club, which feels like a more sort of exclusive space. But in many ways, as you're saying, you know, was a space of collective joy and of precisely the kind of interdependence and camaraderie that I associate with soul, with the best possible versions of and effects of soul music. And I love what you're saying too about it being a space of Black women, driven by Black women and the diva, and this, you know, rage to survive, right? To thinking about Gloria Gaynor, but also the David Ritz's the title of his book about Etta James. In any case, and you know, the fact that some sort of quote unquote soul artists like Diana Ross like just do transition, right, from all the way from Motown, you know, into the disco scene. And I think that, I mean, one thing to say about that is that it's a hospitable space for older Black artists, for, you know, a group like the Weather Girls, who are, you know, just are not fitting that sort of like pristine, cookie cutter standardized image of, Black American femininity or American femininity. And that it's a welcoming space, you know, for somebody like Diana Ross, who was able to reinvent herself there. Sissy Houston is somebody else who ends up, you know, doing some disco tracks, who it's surprising because she was a real gospel boomer, you know, that big righteous voice. And yet even she, you know, ends up recording some disco tracks and bringing her daughter Whitney along with her, so that this crossover Black pop that you're associating with Michael Jackson in many ways just begin in the disco space as much as it does in Motown soul.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak for myself. I've got my own arguments with Nelson George on this one, for sure.
I'd love to hear
disco, I mean, pre-disco was this, it was a space for, you know, basically for marginalized groups, you know, people of color, queers and women to kind of congregate. And it was a major alternative to the space of, you know, the rock concert or the spaces that were associated with rock music. And but it was, you know, it was explicitly utopian form of integration, and it remained in entirely underground, effectively, or more or less entirely underground for the first 5 years of the 70s. And that was when disco was beginning to come through. It was primarily Black music. But by the time Nelson George is writing in 1988, it has a very different salience, because by that point, disco revolves around these these late 70s popularized images of Studio 54 and Saturday Night Fever. And Eurodisco, which was obviously a white, European-based kind of form of disco that did kind of undermine or dilute or veer away from some of the kind of, you know, groove-oriented, soul-oriented R&B aesthetics that are associated with early disco. But, you know, the figures, you know, figures like, you know, Lalisa Holloway and others were, you know, coming right out of the R&B soul tradition. And it was there, it was this kind of, you know, move towards, you know, expressiveness and a foregrounding of kind of, ecstatic collective joy, music that kind of embodied that, that was, you know, a, you know, survival, you know, a reference point of survival and new forms of identity and expression for all of these groups. So, I see it as being very much as being quite connected.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, when I was reflecting as you're speaking on, you know, why I would even say that the club feels like a more exclusive space, or why that's even a problem than the church, you know, because really it isn't. I mean, all spaces are exclusive to some people. The house party is as exclusive as the block party is as exclusive as, you know, the going to that particular church on Sunday, you know, where if they don't know you, people are going to look at you funny, you know. And I think, though, the reason why I said that, or why I would have voiced that as, you know, a potential drawback to the soul collectivity concept, is just because I'm operating from that Studio 54 velvet rope kind of idea of the disco club. But if you take that away, or if you don't, you know, use that as the kind of, reified version of what disco is, then you would see that the dance floor as no more or less exclusive than any other space of cultural production, you know, where soul or other forms are created.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the dance floor was the most, even in these, you know, so-called private parties, they were the most democratic integrated spaces I know of. They were sort of private because they didn't want to be commercialized, and they didn't want to, you know, they were bypassing New York's cabaret licensing laws. They didn't want to serve alcohol because then they were bound by those licensing laws. Everyone took LSD instead. But I mean, one of my arguments around this party called The Loft is it was the most advanced form of melting pot culture in New York City, in the entire history of New York City up to that point. You wouldn't have found a more integrated space. It's just, I think there's no question of this. But you could only fit 250 people in there. I mean, to me, that's never been exclusive. I don't, you know, my feeling about this is, yeah, there's every community has to kind of create some sorts of lines. But I don't know. I don't know how exclusive the church necessarily was. It's not an area I know a great deal about, I'm afraid to say. But I do know a bit about these parties. And there was a vast network of these parties. Studio 54 for me is entirely mm-hmm. different. It's entirely based on the idea of exclusivity, okay. of the velvet rope, of turning people away. And I'm saying this is partly what Nelson George and others were responding to, but that came in 1977. And that's seven years after these other parties are opening. And it just is, as usual, there's a commercialization or a corrosion of the original idea. I mean, as it happens, also Studio 54 closes after 3 or 4 years. One of these parties is still running today, and according to the same set of principles. So, yeah, it's disco gets its bad name from Studio 54 and Saturday Night Fever, and you could say quite rightly, because a lot of these people involved in this scene are also like, they saw disco as just a new ruse within the music industry to find a new way to market what was already basically R&B and soul music. But I take your point that this disco definitely has it comes with its tensions.
So we've been talking a bit about Nelson George and his rejection of disco. So Nelson George, for the benefit of listeners who might not know, I'm sure we've mentioned him before. I mean, Nelson George's book, The Death of Rhythm and Blues, when does that come out? Late 80s? Is this kind of key reference point, really, in a lot of these debates? And it's, I mean, to some extent, it's the thing that a lot of, certainly in Britain, a lot of sort of black cultural studies writers on music are it's the thing they're kicking against a little bit, because its dismissal of disco is seen as sort of continuous with a certain kind of masculinism and a certain kind of authenticism. I mean, he's almost seen, he's like a sort of, you know, there's this term that has been around in the in the British music press from the early 80s, like rockism, this sort of ideology that fetishizes a kind of great rock tradition that includes some black artists, it includes the blues singers, doesn't really include soul, definitely doesn't include disco. And George was seen as a sort of black rockist in some ways, which is sort of carries on into the 90s to some extent. I always remember, I never forget this interview with Chuck D, who was a sort of hero to me, but where Chuck D says, oh, basically what we do is rock and roll. And he hated dance music. He said, all techno house, it's all just disco. And that was a term of abuse. So those are the sort of terms of reference of the debate, like, within which this term post-soul gets coined by George himself. It's Nelson George who first coins this term post-soul to designate this, like, this idea that we're in a historical moment at which, in some sense, that heroic history of soul as the music of black liberation has come to an end. So you gave a really good description of, like, what was at stake, but I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more. Like, well, what is at stake in that historical designation and in people's embrace of it, either as a term that they wanted to valorize or a term they wanted to reject?
Thank you for that context with regard to Nelson George. That was, I think, really useful. And I think what I would say is that Nelson George's study, The Death of Rhythm and Blues, at its best, is cautioning us against valorizing the sort of mainstreaming of Black music and the success, the commercial success of certain Black artists, right? That at its best, he's saying, but who is left behind in this transition, you know, where some people, be that, you know, the great superstar, or indeed the upwardly mobile, you know, Black middle-class, college-educated, regular person, you know, as they are transitioning into, you know, the kind of upper echelons of the American class system, who is left behind? What is left behind? What happens to culture? What happens to community? And just let's not forget the price of what, again, to reference James Baldwin, the price of the ticket here. So I think the study is actually incredibly valuable in that regard. I mean, if that's the sort of takeaway, but there's so much that is fraught about the analysis that I think people tend not to really think about that aspect of it. But I guess what I would say is that at its best, post-soul would be a term that maintains that sort of that critique, right? And that question of what is lost, what forms of community, what forms of organizing, and sort of grassroots efforts are lost in this moment of class stratification and upward mobility, you know, that is enabled by integration. You know, that's why, I mean, the post-civil rights is a useful historical marker, but there are a lot of crucial changes that come about, you know, through the civil rights movement that do enable certain people to, you know, move away from the community and move into these other spaces within the culture. And so, in other words, I think post-soul would grapple with all of that, with the promise as well as the perils of this transition. But it has tended to only valorize the promises. And it has done so because the thing that people turn to is, I think, less Nelson George than a shorter text, an essay by Trey Ellis called The New Black Aesthetic, which is published, I think, also in Kalaloo. It grows out of an essay that Ellis writes in college, I think maybe at Berkeley or Stanford, and he's writing a book where he's writing an essay about Addison Gale's anthology, The Black Aesthetic, which is one of the key texts of the Black arts movement. And Trey Ellis, you know, the college student, you know, in one of the probably early Black studies courses that is offered at this university, is dissatisfied with what he sees as a narrow vision of Blackness and Black culture in that anthology. And he wants to say, well, when I look around at my friends, we're listening to anything we want. You know, the kind of classic line from that essay is both Jim and Toni Morrison, right? We love the Doors as much as we love the Bluest Eye. And we can like everything. And, you know, not only are we college educated, but in many cases, our parents have been college educated. And we're moving like Spike Lee into Hollywood. And we're moving, you know, like, I don't know, who would have been like the greatest athlete of that moment. But we're moving into these spaces of sports and culture and commerce, and we can do anything basically, you know? And I think, and that's such an alluring concept. And even at the time, there were people who were in these groups, like Elisa Jones, who was the daughter of Amiri Baraka, one of his daughters, who were saying, "Ah, not so fast. Like, yeah, some of us, Greg Tate, Elisa Jones, Dre Ellis, get to write for the Village Voice and are sort of part of these new kind of, or not new, but these spaces of culture that were previously barred to us. But again, like, who else being left out? And is it really, you know, the opportunities that we have, like, what does that actually mean for Black people?" It's still, in other words, there's still this sort of sensibility among even Tre Ellis's cohort that, you know, we should be thinking about this broader construct called the people, and working for them. And yet, you know, to conclude a very long answer to your question, I think that when people think about post-soul, they think, as Tre Ellis did, about this new moment of flourishing and possibility. And what is left out is not just a class critique, but also the sense of what came before that post-soul was supposedly liberated from.
Right, right. And it seems to me that it's part of this broader moment within cultural criticism, Anglo-American cultural criticism, whereby what you might call a sort of casual postmodernism becomes normative, whereas anti-essentialism becomes the project, like the valorized term. So yeah. Essentialism, it's not, anti-essentialism does all kinds of good things. I mean, it's important to be anti-essentialist in some ways, but it becomes an end in itself to the point where it becomes very difficult for people to formulate any kind of politics of community on some level.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, that's mm-hmm. why I was thinking when I was reading it earlier that now it's sort of hard to remember, because, you know, there was this whole period in the 90s when I first started teaching. It was the mid 90s, and it was the case that authenticity was a complete dirty word. Like, authenticity was something you only ever thought about in terms of the critique of authenticism. Like, you couldn't really. And soul itself, the whole idea of this soul aesthetic, and soul seemed like this quaint notion and this quaint aesthetic that belonged to this now past moment, which, but that itself now, I mean, that idea itself now seems, especially post BLM, you know, that seems like a quaint relic of the 1990s to me, this idea that you would dismiss the kind of organicism of soul. But that was the moment, that was the vibe, especially in the early 90s, you know, straightening your hair was cool because it was rejecting, it was radical. Straightening your hair was more radical than not doing, because it was rejecting an essentialized identity. Now it seems like a sort of a strange moment in a way, but I think you've given a really good account of why. I mean, what was it? I mean, it's something you can see why it's appealing to people. It's liberating. It was associated with queer, for a lot of people, it was associated with queer politics and feminism and certain kinds of feminism. But to me, your sort of study, it comes out of it belongs to our moment now, to the extent that our moment now politically is as much as anything constituted by a kind of widespread recognition that indeed, as you suggest, George himself was suggesting, too much was going to be lost in that embrace of a kind of consumerist individualism.
That's right. And, you know, I think if I earlier said that Baraka is one of the key figures of Black studies, I think I might revise that and say that I think Audre Lorde might be just as, if not more, important to an understanding of, you know, the intersectional analysis that I think post-soul did not enable, but certainly popularize, right? But also that sense that we can, I mean, what's so valuable about Lorde is that idea that we can have an intersectional analysis, you know, and understand our many differences while nonetheless operating as a kind of community, right? Which Spivak would call strategic essentialism, you know, perhaps. But I think for Lorde, you know, when she theorizes the idea of sister outsiders, right, that people who are drawn together by virtue of their sheer difference from all the other people, and indeed from each other, but that nonetheless create a kind of fragile coalition and make things happen in the world, right? And so, in other words, that we don't have to choose one or the other. We don't have to either be, you know, think about the diversity within Black culture, or think about community. And I think that Black Lives Matter has learned quite a bit and drawn on the teachings of Black feminists such as Lorde in understanding that the two can coexist.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Yeah, I agree, everybody. Lorde is not an anti-community thinker.
Hello, listeners. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Just a reminder, if you want to hear an extended version of this interview, including a discussion on Afro-presentism, Beyoncé, Janelle Monáe, contemporary R&B, and the affect of resilience, become a patron at patreon.com for as little as £3 a month, where you'll be able to get access to extended versions of all our interviews in the current series. Thanks.